Hey, everybody. Happy Friday. It's Trevin McGee again, Scene Stealers podcast. And we're a man down. Malene's gone. He's out. But we got a pretty good replacement. You know, we don't really miss Eric too much when he's not
really
here. Our guest smells a lot better. I'll just say that.
I think
odious.
I look a little bit like Eric. Like just a tad, so maybe I'm just like the younger, like better Eric. Like, that's,
but you wear glasses like me. Yeah. Maybe Eric and I had some bizarre love child.
It's some sort of like alternate reality, or like The Fly. You guys are both in like a teleporter. Matt came
or we
out.
Got a surrogate and we did the swirl.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the swirl. Yeah. So Matt Lloyd is here, Matt, and we're all three going to talk about some. We've got a collective one thing that we're going to save until the end, and it's going to be kind of a tantric one thing, because we're going to save it up and then just explode at the end and talk about it. So the two movies we have to talk about before we get to that are Dirty Wars.
Yeah.
And
that one we get to talk about. That one we don't just have to talk about.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, I'm glad. We have to talk about The Heat. So, yeah, I'll just jump right into
it. If you sat through it, we've got to talk about it.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll just jump into the Heat really fast, and we can move on to Dirty Wars and then the other thing that we're excited about. The Heat is the latest from director Paul Feig, guy behind Bridesmaids, one of the creators of Freaks and Geeks. He's a pretty solid comedic director, and this is his cop movie with Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy, and then really, you know, a random cast beyond those people. You got Michael Rapaport. really strange cast.
Excellent.
Good. Michael Rapaport. Taron Killam from Saturday Night Live actually has a big role in this.
Isn't like Biff Tannen from Back to
the
Future, isn't it?
Biff Tannen is the
I don't actually know that guy.
Yeah, I know I should, but he plays the police chief. And Marlon Wayans playing it straight, you know? So it's such a weird cast. But anyway, you know, Bridesmaids was a huge success and a huge runaway comedy, and Melissa McCarthy was definitely a piece of that. I don't think she was the whole reason that was a successful movie.
No, Kristen Wiig was really, I think, endearing in that film.
Yeah, and it had a personal touch because she wrote it. Amy Mumolo co-wrote it. Like, her hands were in it a lot more.
But it was very funny, but it was also kind of sweet.
Yeah, and kind of sad. And yeah. It had a personal touch to it. The Heat is not like that. The Heat. It's true. The Heat feels like somebody, feels like an executive watched Bridesmaids and said, how can we do that again? Oh, yeah, that one woman was really funny and everyone's talking about her and quoting her. Let's do that. Let's do something with her.
Let's get that supporting character, and then
What's
funny is,
and we found out in Identity Thief that doesn't work, because I had to review that too, and it's the same thing. Identity Thief, they took Melissa McCarthy, who's great in small roles. Like, she, you know, Trey hates this movie, and I shouldn't even say it out loud, but she does totally walk away with, and that's not hard to do, but she does walk away with This Is 40. And she,
I love how you blame me for that.
And
but
she
you
has
hated
one
that movie
scene.
Also.
No, I hated it. I just I don't like.
Yeah,
you know, my blood doesn't boil when
I
hear it. But, you know, she walked away with that movie and she had one scene. Yeah, and her outtake was the only outtake. It was so funny.
I remember after Trey saw This Is 40, because you were like, it was kind of this, I think sort of the vague description you gave me after you say it was like, we should have a eulogy for Judd Apatow's like sense of humor.
Yeah.
And you made it like 40 minutes in. You missed some great, you know,
if I have
disastrous
to, if I
moments.
Have to work that hard to get the great stuff, then
no, I mean, I'm you know, like you thought that it was bad before, like he it got worse.
Yeah,
he debased himself worse. But yeah, she walked away at that movie again. Small role, you know, she had a larger role in Bridesmaids, but it was still very much a supporting role. And then they gave her Identity Thief, and that made a lot of money. And so, you know, like, it worked out for her, and this is probably going to make it. I mean, I don't think it cost anything to make. It's probably going to make its money back this weekend and will end up being kind of profitable in the long term. Maybe it's even some counter-programming. I don't know.
Well, but I think that also people are banking on the fact that, like, Sandra Bullock is, like, still has that sort of girl-next-door cred and, that, you know,
and it's PG-13. No, never mind. It's a hard R. Never mind. It feels like a PG-13 movie because it's so
that
damn.
That seems like
it's
the biggest misguided thing to do is to make a movie that will largely appeal to middle-aged women,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of middle-aged women who also grew up with the sort of Lethal Weapon films
yeah.
that can kind of like balance those two things.
Right.
To make that a hard R seems really misguided. It's like you're...
It's a hard R for language, and that's it.
I think that's actually, that's kind of the thing. I would almost say like the R rating now is kind of a point in a lot of films' favors,
yeah.
but not actually like the actual quality of the film. But it's almost, I think R ratings have kind of become like a marketing thing where they're what drew people in like the 70s and 80s to X-rated films, but like a mom and pop like easygoing version of that, where like middle-aged housewives get to cut loose and go see Bridesmaids or The Hangover or something like
Magic
that.
Magic Mike.
Or yeah. Have some strawberry margaritas with the girls.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay.
So this movie is, you know.
Sounds like a nice weekend.
It would certainly. Yeah, it does.
Magic Mike was fine.
Yeah, no. Yeah, it doesn't really, you know, fit into that. But it does fit into the, like, girls just wanting to go crazy
yeah.
for a weekend.
Girls just wanting to have fun?
Yeah.
I wish there's a song about that.
I and this is true. I dropped my mom and her sister and like three other middle-aged ladies off at the movie theater to go see Magic Mike, and was like, "Okay, you girls have fun." Like, I dropped them off at the Alamo and came back and got them 2 hours later, and they were all drunk. And
Jamie went to Magic Mike for a girls' night out
mm-hmm.
too.
Yeah,
yeah.
We're talking about everything but the movie because there's not a lot of movie to talk about. It's set in the present, but it's got this weird sort of 70s. It tries to be a 70s cop movie, at least in its opening title sequence, and then they have this sort of like Al Green sound-alike opening song. And I actually thought it was an Al Green song I hadn't heard until he starts cursing, and I was like, the Reverend doesn't curse.
Yeah.
It's not Al. But it's, you know... The thing about these movies is you know exactly where it's going to go. If you've watched movies for more than a year in your life, you know exactly how the plot's going to work out and the way it's going to break down. And that's fine. You know, like, I'm a big believer that you can tell the same story as long as you tell it well,
mm-hmm.
you know. And there's not – and as long as you put your own stamp on it or do something original in, like, the – whether it's the characters or the camera work, whatever. It doesn't have to be an entirely original thing. But if you just do something that – gets my attention or is just done well, I'm a big fan. And this just never did any of that. The what improv is there is really awkward and not really well implemented. The action scenes, when there are action scenes, are shot horribly. The plot, totally predictable. No, you know exactly what's going on the whole time, and it's and all of the changes and the character stuff is totally unearned and just kind of there. And it's attempts at like big laughs and big belly laughs don't really ever work. One thing I'll, you know, say in its favor is that it doesn't, with McCarthy, it doesn't do what Identity Thief does, where Identity Thief, like, Rex Reed got a lot of deserved criticism and flack for, he just talked about her size and her weight in his review. That was the entirety of his review. I think he called her a fat little pig at one point in his review. Like, he said horrible things about
wow.
her in the review, and it was all like personal attacks. He's wrong and a terrible person, but what that movie did do that I think maybe he was trying to tap into and he just couldn't because he's a shitty writer, is that all of the jokes were based on like, hey, look at that fat girl.
In
Identity Thief. They're all like, look at that fat girl try and do what... It's funny that she's so sexual because she's fat, and that's subversive to what's sexual. Isn't that funny that she acts like a sexual person because she's so fat? Like, all of the jokes were basically like, oh, hey, the fat girl's trying to dance now. Isn't it funny that the little fat girl dances? Like, those were all of the jokes
that
in Identity
Thief. That
was
the most, like, efficient, deconstructed version of, like, blue-collar comedy humor. Like,
yeah.
It's just point and laugh at the thing that's slightly... different than what it's supposed to be.
Right,
and
right.
Thankfully, this movie doesn't do that. It's
okay.
smarter than that. So it's not just like her falling downstairs or trying to like fit through doors that, you know, it's not like offensive, like, oh, I'm too big for this doorway. You know, it's
right.
like it's physical comedy and she's really vulgar and they let her just kind of go. That's like its biggest saving grace. The rest of the movie
is that it doesn't make too many fat jokes.
That its humor isn't at the expense of its comedic lead. That's like its biggest plus. beyond that,
how did the audience react to it?
There were a couple of moments where it got decent laughter.
Yeah.
I talked to Jack Pressinger last night before Lone Ranger. Mm-hmm. And he said that he'd seen it months ago, and he said that it just killed when he saw it.
Huh.
I didn't ask, you know, I think if he saw it months ago, that means he probably had to go to L.A. or somewhere to see an early screening. But I didn't ask where he saw it, but it didn't really kill where we were at. It got some laughs, but it wasn't great. He said that there were, like, out loud laughs at White House Down. I was like, I want to see that movie. Like, I want to see the Channing Tatum saves the White House with an ass-kicking Jamie Foxx movie. Like, that sounds, like, appropriately absurd.
Yeah.
But this was, like, safe enough that it wasn't funny, and it was smart enough that it should have been.
Gotcha.
So, I don't know. I give it a minor Rock Fist Down just because I was totally underwhelmed, and I wanted it to be better than it was, and I just never got there. But I don't have anything else to say about it. It's pretty unnoteworthy.
Anything else on The Heat?
I mean, I didn't see it. I'm wondering if it's that same kind of thing you see a lot. It's a really weird thing that happens, I think, with like action comedies, where that genre, like the two... I guess like the two nouns that are in its title will like frequently like make the other one disinteresting. Like there are people who try to make action comedies, but like kind of, I guess maybe hope that one, I don't know, pushes it, like is better than the other. I don't know. I've seen so many action comedies where like the action's always like really boring and you don't even know why that's a part of what you're doing. And, I always notice those films are also tend to be just pretty safe in their humor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it's almost like those two genres are like the most, and I love action movies. I love comedies. There's like notable examples in both those. They're some of my favorite movies of all time. But it's just like, it's such a readily appealing genre to like a really basic crowd.
Yeah.
You know, put in some curse words, some shouting, some physical humor, and then like a car chase and,
Yeah. And you know, the other thing that just like looking through the IMDb list of people who were in it, the other big thing that it really, its other big crime is it has a fantastic supporting cast that just gets totally wasted.
Yeah.
Like nothing. Jane Curtin's in it for like 2 minutes as Melissa McCarthy's mom, wasted. Michael Rapaport doesn't have anything to do. Everybody in it, Taron Killam doesn't have much to do. Michael McDonald, not the singer, but the guy from Mad TV, like he doesn't have anything to do.
That would be hilarious.
I know. I was like, oh man, could he please be like the lounge singer? Because the credits fire up, and it's like this 70s thing, and I'm like, oh my god, is this like a 70s movie? And I didn't realize it because that could be really funny. Yeah. And I'm like, man, if Michael McDonald is in like a lounge somewhere playing piano, that's hilarious. Or if one of the characters love Michael McDonald, you know, like,
sure.
I got excited, and then it's the other one. Tony Hale, you know, Buster Bluth, he's got nothing to do. Buster's got nothing to do. There's just all of these people, and nobody have any. And Caitlin Olsen from It's Always Sunny, she does like a shitty Russian accent and is in it for one scene and is gone.
Well, I'm
like,
glad to hear that it's waste. Not, because when I looked at this one,
Bill Burr's like proved himself to be really funny in both Breaking Bad and the Chappelle Show.
Yeah.
And he has shit to do as well. Like, it was just so disappointing.
Yeah. Looking at this, when I knew that I couldn't go and see it, there was part of me that was just like, dang it. Because I knew it was a risky endeavor walking into this film. But I remember when you and I went and saw 21 Jump Street.
Yeah.
Both of us walked in and were like, oh, God, this disaster.
Yeah, we were like, oh, well, we're just going to tough it out together.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it just blew our fucking minds.
And that's the thing, is that I think that there was really an opportunity here with The Heat to be kind of like the female buddy cop version of that.
Yeah.
And
this, a similar thing happened to me when I saw This Is the End last week. Eric already reviewed it, but I was still kind of like, I don't know, whatever. And I was similarly just like, this is way funnier than I thought it was going
to
be.
Yeah, I still need to see it. So,
well, there's an argument between James Franco and Danny McBride that is maybe the funniest thing. It's definitely the funniest thing I've seen all year. It's one of the funniest things I've ever seen in a movie theater. Like, I was crying. And it's just this, you can tell it was entirely ad-libbed and they just had the cameras in the right place.
Was it the magazine?
Yeah.
All that part's hilarious.
It's so funny. And anyone who has seen it, that scene comes up and they're just like, funniest fucking thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
You know, like, every time.
No, it's, it's funny. I think it's interesting to bring up that movie because it's, that's a really great example because that is a movie. And I know it's already I've been talked about, so I'm late to the game.
Sorry,
I'm
too.
But that is a movie that, like, that did just go for it. Like,
yeah.
And it's that movie is, like, really loose. It's sloppy.
Yeah, for sure.
There are parts of it that are just dead.
Like, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That could have been exercised out. But I didn't care because it was, like, it was so committed. And the craziness, like, plot
that they try and stick to. It's okay, whatever. But then, when they leave the house, it's like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Like, they spent some money on this stuff. And that art direction's really interesting and... And then the cameos at the beginning are really well done and funny and
yeah, like that
God,
that movie was
so good.
The movie was really committed. I just
there's a cameo at the end on par with like Bill Murray's appearance in Zombieland. Like it's to me it was that funny. Like when it happened and oh my God, I was like that's pretty good.
But I think I was wondering and I'm disappointed to hear that Heat doesn't live up to the expectations I have on. Paul Feig, the co-star of Heavyweights, as I will always...
Yeah.
He plays the skinny camp counselor in Heavyweights, if you're wondering. I was really surprised when I learned that. I was like, holy shit! but my knowledge of terrible 90s movies is, like, unfathomable.
For all you Paul Feig fans.
Yeah.
all you Feig fans out there.
Nice. I could see the Heat, like... You know, all the previews... But I think the same thing happened with This Is the End, where I was looking at the previews. I'm like, I don't know if they're actually going to like go with this premise all the way, and they did, and it was really good. It was really great. It's kind of how I felt about another Seth Rogen movie that I liked a lot was Observe and Report, which I know some people dislike that movie quite a bit.
Yeah, I loved it.
But I think that movie was just like fucking gun for it. And again, there are parts of that movie that are just dead weight, but like it's just so great that someone's trying to do something different, and I hoped the Heat would have been like nothing in the trailers really seemed like it was really gunning for it, but if it committed, I would have been really interested.
I was hoping it was going to be like the lady version of Hot Fuzz. I was hoping that it was going to be something like that, and it's not.
Yeah.
So we can move on. It's dead in the water and sucked. Right. And so now, Trey, save us from ourselves.
I mean, this is a complete... There's no segue that gets us from the Heat to Dirty Wars.
Speaking of disasters.
Yes. That's true. Dirty Wars is a documentary based on Jeremy Scahill's book.
Yeah. And he's been a very, just some quick background on him, he's been very outspoken about the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. He did a fantastic, fantastic book about Blackwater.
He was one of the instrumental, the journalists that was instrumental in uncovering Blackwater.
Yeah. Fallujah, the Battle of Fallujah and all that. I mean, like, he is one of the reasons that Blackwater no longer exists, actually.
Yeah.
So.
This is directed by Rick Rowley.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's just somebody who is kind of in the Scahill camp and was there and able to work with him, fellow journalist. I'm not exactly sure. But Scahill and his partner David Riker write the whole film, and Scahill himself narrates the entire film. But basically, what Scahill attempts to do in Dirty Wars is continue to kind of basically pull back to larger and larger shells to kind of get some perspective on what the war in terror, what the war on terror has become
mm-hmm.
in the decade that it has existed.
Right.
And that's Dirty Wars in a nutshell. And the way he does that is really fascinating. He starts by very specifically investigating a specific incident that happens in Gardez, which I believe is in Afghanistan. I believe mm-hmm. it's in Afghanistan or Iraq. And I know those are very different countries. I know they're very different wars. But it's a situation where he finds out that a group of special forces knocked on the door of this family gathering around 2 a.m. and just started shooting people because they supposedly had intelligence that a Taliban gathering was there. One of the people at this family gathering was one of the, yes, it was in Afghanistan, was a member of the Afghanistan police force.
I see.
That was trained by the U.S. forces. So it becomes basically this huge, like, FUBAR situation. And what Scahill ends up uncovering, and he's doing all of this research about 2007, 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's 2008, 2009. But as he's doing all of this research, he uncovers the name of McCraven, General McCraven, and JSOC, the Joint Security Operation Council or Committee, Operations Committee. And he can't find it. He basically can't find out anything about these things. So what he realizes is that operating within our military structure is basically a paramilitary organization that is not accountable to anybody except the White House. And so because he keeps on asking NATO, why was this strike ordered? NATO is just like, we have no documentation of a strike ever.
Yeah.
And so he can't figure this out. So he starts to kind of uncover these players. He follows it to Anwar al-Awlaki, which is, so he takes it from Afghans, a group of Afghans getting gunned down mistakenly, to a group of Yemenis having a missile strike kind of exacted upon them,
right.
Which was just a poor, impoverished tribe in Western Yemen. He then follows this whole trail to Awlaki, who is an American-born Muslim who flees to Yemen, ultimately will be killed in a drone strike, and then finally to Awlaki's son, who is a 16-year-old who is killed in this drone strike. And what he basically proposes is that however we are fighting this war on terror, this war that does not have a specific named adversary,
right?
However we are fighting it, what it ends up doing is perpetuating itself. That we, after September 11th, 2001, we had a list of about 10 people that were on the killer capture list. After the
that grew to the deck of 52,
the 55 in Iraq, and then after we were in Iraq for some time, that grew to lists of thousands.
Yeah,
and now there is an ever growing list of names on these killer capture lists, and he basically says that there is just basically this shadow war that's being fought, where the battlefield, since it is a war on terror, the battlefield is the entire earth. And so you can go into Yemen with a missile strike.
Right.
And you can pay Somali warlords to go and capture and interrogate and kill people who are seen as enemies of the United States.
So with a movie like this, and I know Scahill has a very, at least when he dealt with Blackwater, he definitely had an opinion and some concerns, and he was using very journalistic practices to get his information, but ultimately he had a perspective and a viewpoint and opinion that he used his evidence to support.
Sure.
Does that carry into the documentary and how it's presented?
I would say so, but he does it without being overly didactic.
Right.
So this is not a manifesto.
Okay.
This is very much journalistic practices. He's asking questions. And the evidence that he presents is pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
He actually carries this through the death of Osama bin Laden and Anwar al-Awlaki. And he goes from basically meeting constant criticism and denial to JSOC being totally out in the open.
Yeah.
And he said it was really kind of weird. It was like we had just like walked through the looking glass, that it was just like, 2 weeks ago, I was getting adamant denials that this organization even existed or operated in this area to them all being celebrities.
Right.
But he does argue specific points. Mm-hmm. He does argue specific points, and you can tell that he's on one side of the argument.
Mm-hmm.
But he never comes down so hard that you have to be on that side. I think you could look at the evidence and come up with a nuanced conclusion. You probably wouldn't be able to come up with a totally oppositional conclusion to it necessarily. So, I mean, it definitely has a perspective in that case.
Sure. It's hard not to do that.
Right.
You know, it's just I was trying to think, you know, one of the most affecting films like that for me, it's been out in the last few years, Restrepo.
Mm-hmm.
Restrepo was a fan, but it was more of a like you are there because you were there. I mean, it was footage that was happening during attacks. You were seeing, you see people die.
Stahill actually gets footage from the family,
who had
the family members killed by the by the Army Rangers and by the Special Forces teams that like busted in. They actually have cell phone footage of the bodies of their loved ones who were gunned down. So he uses a lot of – he's able to – through this, he gets an interview with Anwar al-Awlaki's dad in Yemen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Awlaki is able to show him home video of the 16-year-old who was killed in the drone strike. Awlaki's son.
Right. His grandson.
Yeah. And so it was just, he does a lot of good, a lot of pretty amazing things to kind of give you as close to a first person account as he possibly can.
Yeah.
And it's pretty remarkable. And, you know, he gets family photos of Awlaki on like fishing trips in Alaska and Anwar al-Awlaki at Disney World. And it's like this kid was an American kid. He grew up in America. And, you know, there was a move from 2002 Awlaki to 2010 Awlaki that radicalized him.
Does it draw a conclusion or does it leave itself kind of open at the end?
It's pretty open at the end. There's no solution offered.
Right.
The only thing that even comes close to a conclusion is that he basically says, however we are fighting this war on terror, we're getting it wrong because we're creating a larger problem.
Yeah.
Like, if the war on terror, if the people we have to kill and capture continues, that list continues to grow every single year because of what we're doing, that's not how you fight a war on terror. You're making the problem worse.
Yep. It's a self-sustaining machine.
Right.
Right.
So that's the closest he comes to a conclusion. He has no offer of a solution to the problem. Really compelling. I mean, it's another one of those documentaries that you don't feel chipper at the end.
No.
It
sounds kind of it's an odd comparison, but it reminds me of Inside Job a lot, just based on how Inside Job was, you know, kind of a little different in the way that it approached the collapse from, like, it had already happened. This is ongoing. But the way you're describing it makes me think of some of the stronger moments in Inside Job, which is another one that just ends like,
here we go. What do we do? Yeah.
They're going to do it again. Yeah. And everyone who's supposed to be there to stop it is in on it. So, you know, go us. Well, where do you come down on it?
I found this film utterly compelling.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's open enough. I think it offers a perspective, but it's open enough to where I think it's absolutely worth watching. I would give it a solid rock fist up.
Great.
Yeah. Are we ready for our one thing?
I think we're ready. Let's end on a chipper note. So this week's one thing, it's a collective one thing. Saturday, tomorrow, the Alamo Draft House for the screening room, they are going to show, I don't have shit to do with it.
are you Trey, coming?
I'm definitely coming.
Okay.
Trey and Matt are going to show Point Blank, John Borman's Point Blank. Lee Marvin in one of my favorite Lee Marvin roles.
And that's high, like, whenever you talk about Lee Marvin.
That's high praise.
That's high praise.
Yeah.
For me, I think it's, God, I'm trying to think of, he's so great in The Killers, and he's so great in even his weird roles like Cat Ballou, but he's fantastic in Dirty Dozen. I mean, like everybody, you know, yeah. Lee Marvin's just fantastic, but he's a band apart in this movie. Which you guys, I mean, you guys set it up, you curated it, so you should.
Well, this was Matt's suggestion, and here is my confession. I am super, super excited for tomorrow because I've never seen Point Blank.
Oh, man.
But I cannot wait. I absolutely cannot wait.
I don't
want
to spoil any of the stuff, well, so we'll just have to talk more abstract.
Yeah, it's 1967. If I haven't seen it by now, that's on me. So.
So Matt, why did you curate? Why did you pick this movie?
This was we all part of the Kansas City Art Institute screening room, the Draft House Film School thing. The guests talk about each, or Trey talks about each week.
Right.
When we started it and we're doing these curated films, we all voted on them as a group. We all also said like there are certain films that if you're in the group and you're part of this panel, like we should make time for everyone to get a certain select amount of films that like. This is just what I know people need to see.
Yeah.
And it's actually funny. This is my two of my choices are coming back to back, which last week we did Phantom of the Paradise, which is one of my all time favorite movies.
And the turnout for that actually was great.
It was awesome.
Really?
It was awesome.
Yeah, it had a great crowd. And then doing Point Blank was I was like, we need to show Point Blank. And it's actually I was telling Trevin, Point Blank was when we first pitched the group, I was in charge of writing up descriptions of what the group could be because at that time it didn't really exist. Obviously, it didn't exist. So we were pitching it to the school and to the draft house. We had to sort of describe like what variations of it could exist. What's a once a month kind of screening room can we do? What's a like bi-weekly thing we can do? And the idea of a once a month event was one of the variations we had come up with, and it was. The idea was that you would show a movie that people had probably seen or had been more likely to see, and then you would show the influences for that film. Or in reverse order, you'd show the influences, then it would lead up to a big event. And there was this big, several months ago, and we were all still really excited about how Drive had come out, which I still think that movie is quite amazing.
Oh, yeah. I rewatch it like every 2 months.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Fantastic.
And I was like, Trey and I were huge fans of it. And I was like, typing up the description. I was like, oh, that could be an event. Because I know a lot of people had seen that movie, and I know a lot of people loved it. And so I was like, that could be the poll is people want to see that again. Let's show Drive, but then show the films that influenced it. That kind of, you could draw a very clear parallel. And so for kind of like the styling, like the pacing, I guess, of the film, I was like, we would show before it The Driver, a Walter Hill film that's really great. And then we would show Point Blank because the most amazing thing about Point Blank is it's such this like kind of really bizarrely languid. There's like just the setups in Point Blank are like kind of borderline surreal.
Oh, yeah. But it's very surreal, especially the sort of climactic.
Yeah. Bit. But it's never. In a way that's like, it's certainly not in a way that's inaccessible.
Yeah.
And it's just in a really fascinating kind of ethereal tone, but still really invigorating.
It's invigorating and it's not, it doesn't go the sort of surreal, whimsical route that Tokyo Drifter does, you know, like where it's just like, I'm bright colors and crazy, you know, like it has a tone that it adheres to very tightly. And I don't know, it's also a masterclass in minimalism, I think. In terms of telling a story simply and directly, and it's just a quintessential guy's movie. It's a crime movie, and it's got Lee Marvin as this guy. Is it Carter or is it Parker? I can't remember.
Isn't it Walker?
It's Walker. Yeah. Oh, I'm thinking of the Parker novels and the shitty Jason Statham movie.
Which weren't those inspired by the same novel?
Yeah.
The Hunter or something
like
that?
Well, yeah. Parker, there are a series of Parker books, and they're fantastic and just kind of gritty, noirish kind of crime stories. There's one I love called Slay Ground, and he is involved in a heist, and the heist goes bad, and he has to, like, run and hide in an amusement park, and the cops find out, and they're on the take, so they shut down the park, and it's just cops and mobsters looking for Parker inside this
Sounds like this, Die Hard in amusement park.
Yeah, it's kind of awesome. It's awesome. It's really good. But, and so go ahead. Yeah.
But yeah, but point blank, the main character of Walker is, and I do agree, like there's very little, it's a movie that has very little dialogue. Mm-hmm. The setups aren't.
Especially from the lead.
Yeah, the setups aren't particularly complicated, but it's also, I think it's a really great movie because it's so, like, it has such a great, you know, John Borman has, in it, like, no matter what movie he's doing, but especially in his better ones, would have such a, such a great amount of control over what's happening on screen. It's a very, again, it's a great line. I think I love Point Blank because it's all these things that could actually go terribly wrong. Like when you say a crime film, but with like a very kind of languid, ethereal tone, mm-hmm. that's like, oh, that sounds boring, but it's not. It's executed perfectly. And when you say things like, I forgot what I was going to say. you say, there's very little dialogue, but it still comes across so great. And I think there's so much,
And it's open to interpretation. There's some nice, you can ask some questions. There's some conclusions that aren't really,
his fundamental motivation, this is one thing I do know about the film, is that his fundamental motivation is always in question. It's why is he doing what he's doing?
Yeah, it's actually one of the... the other thing that a lot of people forget about Point Blank, other than the fact that it's really great in a lot of ways, it also has this really wonderful dark sense of humor that a lot of people forget about it.
Yeah, there's a great sort of car crash. It wouldn't be a chase. It's more of just an intimidation scene that's, oddly funny and kind of out of sync with the rest of the movie.
And I think we should at some point say what the plot of Point Blank is, like pitch it on like a kind of...
Go for it. All I want to do is talk about everything that it's inspired and, I just keep wanting to, say what it's about.
Well, it's a fairly basic kind of plot for a crime movie. I think it's kind of it's an interesting thing where it's sort of like Drive. It's kind of simple plot that's like dealt with in a very complex, interesting way. And
isn't it basically just a neo-noir gangster done wrong kind revenge film?
Yeah, Walker gets double-crossed and he's looking for his money. And the greatest thing, there's this reoccurring gag throughout all of Point Blank that is it is such an amazingly
small amount of money.
Well, that's the greatest joke or one of the reoccurring sort of darkly humorous bits about the film is that he gets double-crossed for, I think it's $93,000. Mm-hmm. And he is double-crossed by, basically, these, it leads up into this idea that it's all actually been a plot by this sort of, almost kind of corporate entity, or a really large-scale syndicate. And so the reoccurring gag is that he's constantly, intimidating people to try and get his $93,000. And there are parts in the movie where there are characters going, why are you doing this? I want my money. It's like, no, that can't be your reason because it's $93,000. We as a conglomerate crime syndicate do not deal in that small of amount of money. Yeah. And he's like, no, I want my $93,000 in cash. And there are characters like, I do not have that insignificant amount of cash on me. I can't give you that.
It definitely, it's inspired a lot of movies. Payback is one of the most obvious ones. The plot is identical.
They're both based on the same story.
Yeah. So Payback is one that it's tied to directly. Indirectly, but Drive and the Driver, the Limey. Yeah. The Limey is a total nod to Point Blank for sure.
Yeah.
I don't have much else to say about it. It's a fantastic little crime movie.
I'm really excited about this.
I bought it at midnight when it came out in 2005 on DVD. Nice. 2005 or 2006. Yeah.
Nice. I'm really excited about this one because one of the kind of areas that I think that up until this summer we've neglected a little bit are the British New Wave directors. So we're going to get in, I think it's Lindsay Anderson, who is the director of If, which we're showing. That's going to show July 20th. So he's one of the British New Wave directors. And then John Borman is one of the people who kind of came out of that also.
What did we have to flip? We had to flip If with something.
We had to flip If with Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Yeah.
So Good, the Bad, and the Ugly will be July 13th.
Yeah, so I'm always amused with just when you have a such a diverse
well, when you like, have an ongoing film series, sometimes it's just hilarious, like how things line up.
Right.
So like this month we had Heavy Metal, Phantom of the Paradise, and then now we're going to go into Point Blank.
And that's leading into it's gonna be like Armageddon.
Armageddon, Good, the Bad and the Ugly, If and then Dog Day Afternoon, like, I think is what it's gonna be.
It's just so weird. Yeah. Spot.
Yeah.
Our theme is no theme. Yeah. We are consistently
Well, I mean, that's, you know, our theme is important films, you know. Some of them are films, like Heavy Metal, the turnout was amazing. You got to come to Heavy Metal.
I did go to Heavy Metal. I found some Alamo gift cards that I had, and so I, like, gorged on a giant milkshake and a White Russian. And,
that's probably the best way to watch
it. Yeah, I was like,
Heavy
I'm
Metal.
Just going to get, I'm just going to go for broke here. So I just grabbed a bunch of junk food and then got a giant popcorn for some reason and just, like, kind of ate it, but I didn't really need to. But yeah, that was the best
movie is not the same without, like, some drink and just the smell, like the classic movie theater smell of popcorn near you.
Yeah.
Well, and the crowd. I mean, that's what made Heavy Metal so fun was the crowd laughing when the stuff that was going on was ludicrous and didn't make any sense.
Man, we didn't get to talk about it very much when it came out or when we were getting ready to promote it. And I don't want to derail, but, like, I love the lack of plot in that movie and just like the Dan and Din story. It was clearly some guy who was like, what about John Carter but boobs? You know, like, big giant boobs. Like, okay. Yeah,
I think my favorite part of seeing Heavy Metal, and, you know, if we're going to just talk about it briefly, but like my friend, one of my good friends, a girl named Erica was there. We were on on this whole row. It was like actually a lot of people in the same row I knew. And there's a partner at the end of Heavy Metal where it's actually kind of supposed to be a really dramatic part where there's this really weird pterodactyl creature thing, and it's wounded and it's like kind of crying, but it's the funniest sound. And we're all kind of giggling, and no one's like really wanting to laugh too hard. And then it hits a wall and goes, and then my friend Erica all the way across the room cackled with
laughter. Has this beautiful, like, out there laugh. Yeah, yeah. Just totally bust up laughing.
And then the entire
theater whole row just laughs. Yeah. Yeah. It was great. And that's exactly how you need to see a movie.
Oh,
like
that's how you need to see that movie.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, pairing it with the South Park parody episode was fantastic.
Yeah.
And watching them back to back, I'd seen the parody episode, I knew how right they got it, but watching it back to back, it's just like, holy shit, like,
it's amazing
and remarkably accurate they got it. Yeah.
But yeah, I go see Point Blank, it's awesome.
Go see Point Blank, the end. Go see it, it's awesome. One of the best Lee Marvin movies ever, and you won't be disappointed. And if you are, then you're a dummy. Shouldn't go to movies.
Yeah, you should stop the whole movies thing. Yeah. It's not for you.
Read, but you can't read because you're a dummy. So just watch.
You missed the point of this art, and you should probably just bow out now.
You say that now, and Trey will be like, "I didn't like it that much." There was some problems.
You know, with John Borman, I don't think I'm in for a treat.
Yeah,
no, I'm in for a treat.
Well, you know, we're gonna go there. I think we're gonna cut it, and you guys go see Point Blank. Don't see The Heat, and if you do see Dirty War, you know, maybe pair it with like a nice
scotch. Nice aged scotch.
Oh, I was gonna say like a walk in the park afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
Or
that
something
would be
something
that
nice
would be
or a cake. Yeah. Go treat yourself to like an ice cream cake after you watch
Dirty
War.
Don't do the scotch unless you just want a good sad drunk.
Or like go to Petco and just look at all the puppies.
Then
leave. You know, hold a few and act like you're gonna buy them and then don't buy anything.
I'm really thinking of adopting all of these cats that I'm picking up.
Yeah. Just something to get you through the day.
Sure. But,
all right. Anyway, we'll be back next week. We're gonna talk about The Lone Ranger. And that's it. I think it's just going to be The Lone Ranger. I really can't wait because we've been doing this for like almost 2 years reviewing movies together. And so I feel like I know you well enough to know when you will just fucking hate something. And I can't wait to like just tell you plot points from the movie and have you react and laugh.
So
that's what you have to wait or look forward to. So we'll see you next week.